From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2010 with the Supreme Court's landmark decision in the Citizens United case. With that, the court ruled that corporations, labor unions, and other associations were protected just as individuals are protected under the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment, meaning their political speech or contributions to political campaigns cannot be restricted. Well, with that, corporations and unions were allowed to pour millions of dollars into super PACs or political action committees. People in favor of campaign finance reform say the influence of corporate money can suppress voter turnout, reduce trust in government, and shift the focus from voter priorities to those of companies or donors. To those advocates, the Citizens United decision was a major blow, one that they say has threatened democracy for the last decade. But the co-authors of a new book say campaign finance is misunderstood by just about everybody, and reform is not a cure-all for what ails American democracy. In Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters, authors David Primo and Jeffrey Milo argue that super PAC spending doesn't dominate campaigns, and making changes in state-level campaign finance laws have little to no effect on attitudes toward government. In fact, after analyzing decades' worth of survey results, their research shows that despite popular belief, money doesn't just buy elections, and campaign financing does not drive Americans' distrust in government. They also conclude that a lot of reform efforts have produced no change when it comes to trust in government. Well, this hour, we talk with Primo and Milo about their work, about Americans' views of campaign finance, and how those perceptions affect or do not affect politics. I'd like to welcome our guest. David Primo is the Annie and Mark Gabrielian Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. Professor Primo, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back with you, Evan.
And Jeffrey Milo is Professor of Political Economics, Law and Economics, and Health Economics, and Chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri. Jeffrey, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We have a lot of ground to cover, and I'm going to start with this. David, you know, you and I have had conversations about perception versus reality. I conclude after about 160 pages of your book that, I don't say this derisively, but I think you guys have concluded that Americans really just don't know much about campaign finance at all.
That's without a doubt correct. We surveyed about 4,000 Americans over a couple of years, over 2 years, and you know, we asked them very basic questions about money and politics, and they did very poorly on those sort of quizzes that we gave them. They answered really no better than randomly. They were just as well, might as well throw darts at a dartboard.
David, can I? They could throw darts, or as you write in the book, literally a monkey throwing darts could get more answers correct than the average American when asked to answer about campaign finance.
Yeah, so in fairness, we wish we could take credit for that line, but of course, this is a famous experiment that the Wall Street Journal did with regard to stock picking. And there's sort of an analogy there, right, that you know, there's just no the ability to actually understand the system has been sort of short-circuited because of the way that campaign finance is covered. That's one of our arguments in the book, that when you see the way that reformers talk about the corrosive nature of money in politics, the way the media covers high-profile races with millions of dollars being spent and doesn't focus on other aspects of the system, you could be forgiven for thinking that corporations can do whatever they want when it comes to campaign finance and so on. To be clear, we're not blaming the American public for their lack of understanding of campaign finance. It's a function of the fact that they're busy. Money in politics is not their priority. And when they do get information on money in politics, it comes from the media, who has an incentive to focus on the extremes. And it comes from reformers who are simply wrong when it comes to campaign finance.
Professor Milo, what do you hope readers will take from this then?
Well, from this particular point that people are not very well informed about existing regulations or even the, you know, relative amounts of money that are contributed by different types of groups. I mean, this isn't surprising. It's an application of what is generally thought of as rational ignorance among the public. We don't, you know, really need to have an encyclopedic knowledge of every regulation out there. So if we were to similarly ask people about regulations on absentee voting or primary enforcement of seatbelt laws, we might find a high level of ignorance in general. Where it becomes important, though, would be, one point is if people generally want reform, if they don't know what the existing legal framework is, they may actually think existing laws are quite sufficient or maybe even go too far. And so it becomes relevant when it comes to advocating for reform or interpreting public opinions about expressions for reform, whether they're well informed or not, then becomes relevant.
Well, Professor Primo, let's talk a little bit about priors here. And my card's on the table here. First of all, I appreciate evidence-based thinking, and I love when new evidence changes my mind on something. I find it really refreshing. I find heterodox thinking really interesting. And certainly there is kind of an orthodoxy about the need for campaign finance reform in some fashion. That sort of is pretty pervasive in this country. I also, part of my priors are that I don't deny the fact that I think it's hard to think of money not impacting political outcomes. So let me just start with that prior. So if I come into this book thinking money is what impacts the way people who are elected govern, can you dissuade me or someone else of that?
So the word impact, right? That's a word
largely that guides and controls.
Yes. Okay. All right. So that's more precise.
Okay.
Good. Because there's no doubt in my mind that money, right, has an effect on politics, right? You need money to actually, right, be able to, you need resources, to be clear, of which money is one sort of resource to have an impact on the system. There are other sorts of resources. For instance, you can have volunteers who can provide mobilization for an issue and so on. But to your point about impact or controlling the process, talk to a CEO of a company that's trying to have influence in the system, and I can assure you they will tell you they do not control the process. Corporations, precisely because they don't control the process, have to engage in a tremendous amount of lobbying on issues that are important to them. There's a lot of evidence that the way businesses try to have influence on politics is by mounting public campaigns to convince constituents of elected officials that this issue matters, should matter to them, and they should make their elected officials aware of this issue. So this idea of corporations come in and they, plop down some money on the table and all of a sudden they get what they want. It's a nice story, but I just don't think it accurately reflects the way politics is done, generally speaking. Are there exceptions? Yes. Are there problems with corruption in Albany? Absolutely. But in terms of thinking about the system as a whole, that just doesn't ring true to me, and the empirical evidence doesn't bear that out. One other quick point on this is that if you look at corruption in Albany, if you look at corruption around the country, it's often has nothing to do with actually campaign finance. It's bribery of other sorts. So in other words, if there's going to be corruption in the system, those that are corrupt don't need a loose campaign finance system to be corrupt. They can find many other ways to be corrupt.
Well, both of you. Is that you, Professor Milo? If you want to jump in there, go ahead. And then I've got others.
Yeah, I do want to jump in because it's a great question and it's the natural question for anybody. And it's definitely the case that if you do a public opinion survey like we do and ask people, are elective offices essentially for sale to the highest bidder? The vast majority of the general public agrees with that.
Both major parties. Yes.
Yes, and if you ask people, are campaign contributions the equivalent of bribes, vast majority of the general public agrees with that. Or if you ask, is there too much money in politics, the vast majority agrees with it. So, yes, that is absolutely a conventional wisdom among the general public. For both Dave and I, and other scholars who have studied what we might call the treatment effect of campaign contributions on policy outcomes, or the treatment effect of election spending on how well a candidate for office fares, the nagging result is that money alone doesn't seem to have a great impact at the margin, Now, that's decades of research, and we could spend multiple shows on each of those. But suffice it to say, when we did an opinion survey of others who study money and politics for a living, this is our survey of experts that we talk about in the book. One of the biggest differences, we say there's two conventional wisdoms, right? There's a conventional wisdom among the public that money dominates and drives outcomes. The conventional wisdom among experts who study money and politics, not just Dave and I, is that that's not true at all. And so I would point to that result as a summary statistic for the importance of campaign contributions or campaign spending is really difficult to establish, especially at the levels the general public seems to believe.
I think there's kind of two important themes. I mean, there's many themes in the book, but there's two important themes to me that I want to spend some time on. Later in the hour, one of the themes I want to talk about is how we define corruption. And the authors who are our guests this hour point out that Americans, first of all, define corruption very broadly. And Americans tend to say that your political campaign contributions are corrupt while mine are virtuous. And that is, I think, an unhealthy sort of paradigm. We're going to get to that later in the hour because I am very concerned about that. But then the other theme is this argument that, well, we've kind of got it wrong here, that money doesn't just buy seats and outcomes. And I want both of you, if you could, to respond to two very, very different people arguing close to the same thing. It isn't every day that Donald Trump and Harvard professor Larry Lessig are arguing the same thing. But here's a quote from Donald Trump from 2015. Here's what he said about why he gives money to politicians. He writes, quote, or he said, quote, he doesn't do much writing. He said, quote, "When you give money to politicians, they do whatever the hell you want them to do," end quote. That's Donald Trump. And I want to listen to Harvard professor Larry Lessig, who has spent years, of course, lecturing and writing about money and politics, talking about how he sees the actual outcome difference steered by money and often steered away from the interest of most Americans.
"I find that when Americans with different income levels differ in their policy preferences, actual policy outcomes strongly reflect the preferences of the most affluent, but bear virtually no relationship to the preferences of the poor or middle-income Americans. A vast discrepancy exists between what our Congress would be doing if our Congress were following what the people wanted and what our Congress does, given our Congress follows what the most affluent want." Now, you could say, well, the most affluent are just the smartest, the most educated. And as a professor, I'd love to believe that if it were true. But it turns out, sad to confess, the most affluent are not the best educated. They're not the wisest. This is not government doing wise public policy choices. This is government following what the richest in our society want. And guess what? They are also the people giving the most to the campaigns.
That's Harvard professor Larry Lessig, a longer version of Donald Trump's comment saying, when you give money to politicians, they do whatever the hell you want them to do. Professor Primo, let me start with you. If you've got Trump and Lessig on the same side, you got to work hard to convince people they're both wrong. How are they wrong?
You know, I wish we had 2 hours to talk about why they're wrong. There's so many errors in what you just played back from Larry Lessig. And Donald Trump's statement is just factually incorrect based on, again, using Jeff's language, decades of research on policy outcomes and their relationship to campaign contributions. And with regard to Larry Lessig, he makes a couple of crucial errors there. And, you know, the first error is that he implies that there is some will of the people out there that we just need to get money out of the system so that we can find out what the will of the people is. And the will of the people is whatever the majority says. And of course, right, we do not have a purely majoritarian system. In fact, our system was designed precisely not to be majoritarian. So to simply say a majority of Americans thinks X, the outcome is Y, therefore money dominates the system, is a very, it's a schoolhouse rock or a cartoonish view of how politics actually plays out. And then to say that there's a correlation between who gives the most and who has the most impact, ignores the fact that the people who give the most may also be the ones who are the most politically engaged, the ones who are the most likely to reach out to elected officials and so on. So there's a problem here of campaign contributions being a proxy for lots of other ways in which people reflect an interest in politics.
Okay, Professor Milo.
And just to add to what Dave says, I mean, both Trump and Lessig are showmen, and you know, they are they're demagogues, and both of them. I mean, just because Lessig is a professor doesn't mean he's not a demagogue. He makes a good living at it, and he does not conduct scholarly research on the empirical effects of campaign contributions or election spending. So he's more of a consumer of some of that research and puts a particular spin on it. But, you know, let's take it this way. If corporations could essentially buy public policy, then it would seem to follow that they would invest a lot of money into that. And again, that's a conventional wisdom. Ooh, you know, Exxon gave $1 million to politicians over the last 25 years. Well, Exxon didn't do it. It was their PAC. It came from individuals who work at Exxon. But those complications aside, when you add up all of the political spending of corporations and compare it to how much is, say, spent on lobbying by corporations. Now, two different things. Lobbying, that's spending money to talk to people, you know, kind of quietly and try to influence them. But if you could literally buy things, then maybe you'd spend more on contributions and less on lobbying. Big corporations spend an order of magnitude or more on lobbying versus contributions. And then what about charitable contributions by corporations? That's an order of magnitude or more that corporations spend on charity. So if you think of corporations as having some pool of discretionary funds that they could use to try to influence the public or public policy, way more goes to charity and other, and activities like that, than actually donating money to politicians. So corporations themselves, by their revealed preferences or revealed activities, invest a lot more money in things other than trying to influence politics. Now, it's changed a little since Citizens United.
But Professor, are you under the impression that charitable giving is all altruistic and it isn't driven by the currency that comes from reputation, connection, influence?
Oh, no, not at all. That's not dependent at all. But it does suggest that the marginal efficacy of giving money is greater from that route, giving to charity, than giving to politicians. So Trump's claim that you give money to politicians, they do whatever you want, we would expect, that a lot more money would be given to politicians. And we should make clear, corporations and unions cannot give directly to candidates for federal office. One of the natural experiments we leverage would be at the state level. Different states have different laws, and some states allow corporations to give money directly to candidates, others do not. You can look at the influence on public policy, and it's really hard to find any. It just is really hard to find any. And that's why the experts who study this for a living have such a different view. It's more like 10% of the experts who study money in politics think campaign contributions are equivalent to bribes, where it's more like 80% of the general public. And then similarly for the effects of election spending. So this is kind of, like Dave said, we could spend a lot more time on the empirical realities. Our book actually uses this as a jumping off point to then move on to other things. But a key point is the world doesn't work the way a lot of people think it does, that this overly cynical and, kind of helpless view that people have of American politics just isn't true.
Well, and actually, when you talk about contributions and the way Americans view contributions as equivalent to a bribe, what concerned me, among many things, reading the book, is the idea that Americans have come to view. So I would view my own contributions as virtuous, but I would view yours, if you give to a different cause, as a bribe. Or we view our ideas as worthy of protection and are valorous, where yours are nefarious and intent. Let me go ahead and quote part of your book here. You write, Americans are less tolerant of speech if they disagree with or dislike the speaker. Democrats and liberals are more willing to protect the speech of individuals and unions than corporations. And Republicans are more willing to protect the speech of individuals than unions. And the identity of the speaker matters even for corporate political speech. For example, Democrats are twice as likely to defend the speech rights of Ben & Jerry's compared with ExxonMobil. And individuals supporting stricter environmental regulations also are more willing to silence ExxonMobil relative to Ben and Jerry's. Professor Milo, how much should we be concerned about how we are starting to view one another just in terms of how we view sort of morals based on who you're voting for, who you're giving to, and what it represents?
Well, and I think you put your finger on something that is, you know, it's an excellent point. It's and it's bigger than just our book, this increasing polarization in the way we view each other. You know, to have a free and democratic society, there's got to be some tolerance and some appreciation for an open society and free exchange of ideas. And so that's a bigger theme than just our book. The examples you gave, the quote was based on survey experiments where we run, we give people a scenario about would they favor regulation in a particular context or not, and then vary the setup so you can make these kinds of causal inferences about basically people view restrictions on speech through a very partisan lens, and as you put it very well, that our own activities and people like us are valorous, but people on the other side of the spectrum we're very suspicious of. That's all very natural, but if we take it to the extreme, it is going to make it difficult to continue to have a free and open society that we've enjoyed.
Yeah, Professor Primo, you want to add to that, please?
I mean, this topic of what social scientists called affective polarization, that we dislike other people precisely because of their views, is something that needs to be addressed in American society without a doubt. And it actually ties back to what we were talking about earlier with corporations, because you said earlier in the hour, you know, you have this, you know, there's this sense out there, right, that corporations are simply get, you know, buying what they want, or money's buying outcomes. And to sort of we need to sort of check our views about whether that's viewed again through a partisan or ideological lens. Here's a thought experiment. In the last few months, we've heard a lot about corporations saying we need to be better stakeholders of society. We need to step up all of these corporate social responsibility and sustainability pledges. Well, what is that? That's corporations essentially trying to influence policymaking. And we've heard corporations need to step in because the government isn't acting on climate change or on other issues that are important to many Americans. But yet, I would venture to say there's going to be a huge overlap between the people who say that corporations have too much influence in politics and the individuals who say, but corporations, it's great when they take, you know, essentially implement policies as a group on the environment or on issues that are important to us. And that seems to me there's a fundamental disconnect there in terms of why corporate attempts to influence policy outcomes in Washington are problematic, but corporate attempts to influence policy outcomes on issues like sustainability or the environment privately through their own changes in their behavior, that's great.
Our listeners are flooding the phone lines, and I haven't even mentioned the number. So we're going to spend our second half hour just on feedback. The book, listeners, is called Campaign Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. Authors are David Primo and Jeffrey Milo, who are guests on the hour today. And Professor Primo, just briefly, you said at the top that, yes, Americans get it wrong when you just ask them basic questions about how the system works or what's actually happening. One of those areas that you find people get wrong a lot is if you ask them, well, how much money comes from super PACs or, you know, what people perceive to be sort of dark money. How do we get that wrong?
Americans, when we asked them in 2016, what percentage of campaign money comes from super PACs, we graded them very generously, right? If they were close to the answer, right, they would get it correct. Most people thought that it was the majority or some huge proportion was spent by super PACs, when in fact it's a very, very small amount. that actually from super PACs. And so the way in which they get it wrong is that it's not just that they're wrong, it's that they're wildly wrong, right? They're not even close to being correct. And again, do I blame them for being incorrect? No. Over 75% said that spending was over half, super PACs accounted for over half of spending. Only 5% answered that it was 30% or below, which is a generous interpretation of the correct answer. So they're wildly incorrect. Why? Because Stephen Colbert used his platform to talk about super PACs, because the media did nothing but talk about super PACs. And so they had this outsized influence in the national discourse. So Americans would be forgiven for having it wrong. The problem becomes that the Americans who had it get it wrong, that affects how they perceive and think about reform. So it actually has these effects on their behavior and their perceptions of policy. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, very quickly, Jeff mentioned this idea of the public's sort of lack of knowledge and why it matters. One other reason why it matters is that the Supreme Court says that it matters. The Supreme Court says how the public perceives money in politics is a justification for restricting First Amendment rights. So if we're going to say, if the court's going to say that that's a justification for restricting First Amendment rights, then it's vital what we're doing here to point out their perceptions are grounded in factual errors. And in an era when we're all concerned, right, that facts don't seem to matter much anymore, this seems really crucial.
And just to extend on Dave's point, so I think 2016 super PAC spending was on the order of about 12 or 15% of all political spending. But a very small fraction of that comes from corporations or unions. Most super PAC spending, these independent expenditures, would be from ideological groups or ideologically motivated individuals, people who want to have a say. It's not corporate spending. That would even be a much smaller percentage.
We're going to take our only break of the hour. And when we come back, our listeners have queued up a lot of questions for Professors Primo and Milo as they talk about their book, Campaign Finance and American Democracy, what the public really thinks and why it matters. It's an effort to cure what they see some miseducation and misinformation that has become very common in the American discourse about campaign finance reform. They point out as well through their own collection of data and research that unfortunately, whatever reforms have come our way with campaign finance reform, the American public does not trust government anymore as a result of it. So if the idea is let's get the trust back in government, let's reform, the authors point out it hasn't worked. They also point out that when you ask a broad swath of the population, most people do not want publicly financed campaigns. So it's a question of what's actually happening versus what we're told. What do we do with this information? How does it impact trust in government going forward? And how can we use this information more effectively? Let's come back with your questions for them next. Coming up in our second hour, the remarkable story of one of the hottest wine bars in the world, located in Manhattan, dealing with the tragedy of COVID-19, loss of life, businesses closing, having to decide this past spring what to do. Well, they found a little place in the Finger Lakes that was available, rounded up some trucks, and brought their Manhattan location right to the heart of the Finger Lakes. Did you know it's here? We'll tell you the story next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. First an email, and then your phone calls. Alex writes to us to say that he thinks the guests that we have on the program, the authors, are ignorant of what actually happens in politics. He says, I'm guessing they've never run for office or managed a campaign as I have. This is not just money as corruption. It's the inordinate amount of time spent on fundraising rather than actually getting to address issues. It also stifles what a candidate will do or say if the candidate is fearful of losing the big contributions. And that happens. When you take a check, there are unstated strings attached. There is pressure. Maybe the media shouldn't attach so much attention to candidates' fundraising, true, but sometimes it doesn't matter. What matters only is that politicians think money matters. So, okay, professors, Alex is saying he has both run for office and managed campaigns. There is pressure when someone writes a check. There is expectation. All of a sudden, you're rewriting speeches. You're changing your platform. He says it happens all the time. Do you disagree with that, David?
happens all the time. Does it happen? You can always find examples, right? You can, as I mentioned earlier, with regard to corruption, for instance, does it happen? All the time, I would say it's not as common as, again, the conventional wisdom would have us believe. May there be, especially at the state and local level, implicit pressure? I don't know. I can't get into the heads of politicians. What I can say is that when you actually study the relationship between campaign contributions and policy outcomes, that relationship is far weaker than would be the case if this were the way of the world. To be fair, to Alex's point, though, there is research that's been done by others suggesting that this might not affect policy outcomes directly, but it might affect them indirectly in terms of which issues get on the agenda, in terms of how bills are written, in terms of the details of legislation. But that is a far cry from, and that research is, there's debate about that research. But by and large, right, we're not seeing this one-to-one relationship between contributions and outcomes. Do politicians spend a lot of time raising money? Without question. Is there a better way? Well, one, argument would be if we actually had no restrictions on campaign contributions, politicians would actually spend less time raising money because they would be able to receive larger checks. I can sort of see the heads exploding in the audience as I say that, right? How can, most, I suspect, in the audience think we need more strict, stricter laws, not looser laws. But in fact, one of the reasons maybe politicians are spending so much time raising money is that they're actually constrained in the size of the contributions they can receive.
All right, if I can jump in here too, the statement is about there's some influence from money, and of course there's going to be influence from money. There is influence from party leaders. There is influence from special interest groups more generally, and there are all kinds of pressures. Don't go against the party leaders. Don't go against certain constituents. And so if you were to, wave a magic wand and remove all money from politics, by no means would you be removing the influence and the constraints that are felt by candidates and the pressures on candidates. That would be naive. And so that's part of the one of the themes of the book here is that there's so much focus on money, and we need, if we had campaign finance reform, of X flavor or Y flavor, everything would be better and different and trust in government would go up. We can look at the experiences of the states that have very different laws and have laws that have changed over time and say, do we see changes? And the answer is no. And that's because there's just so much focus on money and less of an appreciation for politics in general is about this kind of influence and compromise. And just closing off one spigot is not going to bring us into some, ideal world where the general will gets implemented.
Well, Kathy directs us to a piece in the Washington Post from last week about Louis DeJoy, and I'll quote from the piece in the Washington Post, quote, Louis DeJoy's prolific campaign fundraising, which helped position him as a top Republican power broker in North Carolina and ultimately as head of the U.S. Postal Service, was bolstered for more than a decade by a practice that left many employees feeling pressured to make political contributions to GOP candidates, money that DeJoy later reimbursed through bonuses. Former employees now say. Five people who worked for DeJoy's former business, that's New Breed Logistics, say they were urged by DeJoy's aides or by the chief executive himself to write checks and attend fundraisers at his 15,000-square-foot gated mansion beside a Greensboro, North Carolina country club. There, events for Republicans running for the White House and Congress routinely fetched $100,000 or more apiece. So here's a guy racking up money, rounding up contributions, and now I'm sure Louis DeJoy, Professor Primo, is head of the U.S. Postal Service because he's got a lot of experience with mail. I'm sure he's just a really good manager of mail businesses. Does anybody believe that? Do you believe that?
I hear skepticism in your voice.
I am a skeptic on this. Help me. Help me, Professor.
This is why we think our book's important is that we're trying to look at the empirical evidence versus anecdotes. But let's look at the anecdote because I think it's actually there's ways to unpack this that are consistent with our argument. First of all, let's assume that everything in those allegations is true for the sake of discussion. Then there's a violation of campaign finance law, right? So this is an activity, his activity of coercing employees to make contributions, if that's what he did. That, if that allegation is true, that's a violation of existing campaign finance law. But again, that goes back to the point of a lot of times when we see politicians get into trouble with evasions of the laws, it's precisely because these laws are so convoluted and restrict behavior in such ways that he couldn't just write the check himself. He felt this pressure to try to get his employees involved, not justifying the behavior, to be clear. He violated the law, he violated the law. But the point here is, and so I guess to your point, though, suppose he was allowed to write the humongous check on his own and didn't have to coerce his employees to do it, and he did, and then he became the head of the Postal Service, wouldn't that be evidence that that the money bought influence? Well, there's another way to think about that, and that is that those contributions were a signal to Trump that this would be somebody who would be a loyal appointee and would do the president's, implement the president's agenda. Now, you can disagree with the president's agenda with respect to the Postal Service, but the idea, right, is that a president wants to have people running agencies who are loyal to the president, and that's a really good proxy for loyalty to the president. So that's a different way of thinking about, did he, buy the Postal Service seat? And also, it's not like that's a plum job. Right. It's not that this is a job that is going to.
I have a list of others. I've got ambassadorships. There's lots of people who are big old fundraisers who get jobs that you don't think are plumb, but they are in high profile positions now.
Right. There's no doubt that those who are loyal to a candidate will. And this has been going on in American history before we had the modern campaign finance system. They're called patronage appointments. This is not something that is new to Donald Trump. But again, there's this idea of loyalty, and there's actually a really deep literature in political science looking at the trade-offs between loyalty and competence in politics. Do you want somebody who's going to be running an agency who is perhaps not the most competent, but is going to be very consistent with your policy preferences, or do you want somebody who's going to be more competent, but may not always implement the preferences that you want? So I don't think this is as nefarious as you're sort of portraying it to be. Maybe Jeff will disagree with me. I don't know.
Well, I think there's another point here, and this is getting a bit broader, but bringing us back to the book, which is the American public has a very broad notion of what is corrupt. And I think it's fair to say that influence, and especially influence that we see in among, the party that we don't align with, is corrupt. That's not the Supreme Court's definition of corruption, and that is not what the Supreme Court has established as the only permissible reasons to regulate political campaigns and political speech, which would be to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption, not broadly the way the American public defines corruption, but in a very narrow sense, literally bribery, influence peddling. And so the Supreme Court, when it's talking about, in the United States with the First Amendment, when is it permissible to regulate political speech only for the purpose of preventing bribery and influence peddling? And when those laws are narrowly construed toward those ends, not more generally influence, which is politics. Politics, American politics, European politics, it's about influence and power, and you can't separate influence, whether it's by the wealthy or by interest groups, from politics in a democratic society. So that leads us more back to a theme of our book, which is the American public, when it complains about corruption, is really complaining about politics. Politics is icky, and normal people are turned off by it. And that distaste, though, is not something that the Supreme Court said rises to the level that it would justify restrictions on political activity and political speech.
Well, let's get more to your phone calls here. And this is John in Geneva next on with the professors. Go ahead, John.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I The main question that I have here is, are these laws designed to be opaque enough that when you spend a lot of money and you gain access that normal people just can't have? You know, I would have expected that with these super PACs, I could give a dollar to a super PAC and I would have, you know, basically put my influence into that bucket. They're going to spend it the way they want to. But if you can't track this money down, what, you know, the opaque nature of these super PACs turns me off. It makes me feel like, you know, there's an influence, or not necessarily an influence, but just access to influence that normal people can't have. And the corporations or big donors had exhausted their capability to gain that access. So now there's a new way to do it. And, you know, I consider myself educated, but ignorant to the process, if that makes any sense. So, you know, that's kind of where I am. I also, you know, I don't know if it's type 2 error or type 1 error, but, you know, I really have a hard time with saying that just because there is no empirical evidence does not mean that it doesn't exist. And if there are opaque natures to, you know, built into legislation, that's the point. You know, that's how money is laundered. You know, that's how things work. You're not supposed to be able to get the empirical evidence of it. Therefore, there'd be a crime. So, I mean, maybe I'm a little cynical, maybe I'm a little left leaning, maybe, you know, I don't know, but, you know, that's kind of
no, John, I'm glad you called, because I think your self identifying as being somewhat cynical is exactly what they're writing about in the book, and I think that you're being honest about how you view the system. I will say that this book I helped discover about myself that I'm ignorant about how a lot of this works too, which is why I'm grateful that the book is out there now. Professor Milo, I'll let you start there on his concern about super PACs and access. Go ahead.
Well, again, neither influence nor access are illegal. And it's not just moneyed interests who have influence and access. It's anybody who's on one team or the other. If you're a loyal Democrat and you're working hard to get Democrats elected and you do it successfully enough, there is a patronage job for you. And, you know, that's politics. And so, you know, we are looking narrowly at the way the Supreme Court defines corruption. And that's one of the big themes of the book, this big difference. But let's take, you know, these super PACs. They're not that opaque. You know, Act Blue. What are they going to do with the money? You give money to Act Blue, they're going to support Democrats for office, period. And so, you know, what more do you need to know? They are, you know, effectively on the Democrat team. And similarly, we could line up the super PACs tend to be ideological and, you know, wear their ideology on their sleeve. And so there's no mystery about what they're about, who they support. And so, you know, the kind of independent expenditures are at the federal level. Donors have to disclose who they are, what their employer is, even their address. And so, you know, there is disclosure. And that's where some of this ignorance comes in, by saying, oh, well, we don't know who's behind that. Sure, we do. And we don't know what their agenda is. Absolutely, we do. They tell us. That's the whole point. They're trying to argue to sway public opinion. And so there's really no secret about it. But that is the stuff of politics. It is people pooling their resources to try to influence fellow citizens. That's what politics is, and it's hard to get away from it. But again, to come back to the book, I mean, I think it's healthy to have doubts, and the caller, you know, kind of self-identified as maybe more to the left. This is not a left-right issue. Republicans and Democrats, I mean, Republicans tend to be a little bit more friendly toward money and politics and free speech nowadays, but partisans on both sides, or whether you're liberal or conservative, view with great suspicion money and politics and the motives of people who are on the other side of the spectrum as being bought and sold. That's pretty universal. So you have to kind of be willing to step outside that partisan lens, that ideological lens, and try to look at the world objectively. But for me, I think the crowning piece of evidence comes when we say, well, how do reforms that are motivated by what we think is a wrongheaded view of the world, how do they work in practice? If we're wrong and reformers are right, they should produce some pretty important results when it comes to trust and confidence in government or changing the way in which politics runs. And I don't think if you look at Wisconsin or look at Connecticut, a state that has public financing, you're going to say that politics is somehow much more healthy and very different than in another state, like, say, my home state of Missouri, where it's a bit more laissez-faire about campaign finance.
Let me have Professor Primo respond to the next question. We're going to try to squeeze in as much as we can. Roy in Rochester. Go ahead, Roy.
I'm still trying to get over spitting my coffee out when I heard the opening of this. Yeah, this is really outrageous, annoying, effective. I've been listening, and in 1973 I went to a statistical conference and I heard a paper from a young student on generalship on the Eastern Front. And he concluded that Manstein and Zhukov were equivalent. And I couldn't prove anything different because they'd never been photographed together. Were they just the same person? It was the height of academic whatever. And I can see that you spent a lot of time on this. And I guess I'm one of the people who can't understand it. We've talked money, we've talked influence, we've talked corruption, we've talked, well, you know, if you get what you want, maybe that was it, without necessarily being illegal, because we got plenty of examples of illegality. I was going to say Don Blankenship. I don't have to run a candidate. I just create a PAC, create an issue about child abuse, run it against the sitting incumbent judge, and I get somebody else. And miracle, he votes for my lawsuit.
Okay.
Well, there's lots of trouble. Explain it to me.
Professor Primo, go ahead.
I think part of what I tell my students is that, you know, learning is often uncomfortable, and we need to challenge ourselves and check our sort of preconceived notions about the world. I would encourage the listener encourage Roy to take a look at our book, take a look at our whole argument, and the fact that what we're trying to do, and it's ironic, right? The last two callers sort of had this view of, well, you can't prove, you know, just because we haven't found evidence doesn't mean that evidence, that's not the case.
David, the story he just shared about Don Blankenship is true. I lived and worked in West Virginia.
Yeah.
The coal industry has enormous influence over environmental law, over state government there. What it seems that what your argument is, that is not always the norm, or that is that we are sort of conflating corruption with, I don't know, different ideas. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, putting ads out and convincing voters to vote in one way or the other, that seems to me to be the fundamental of American democracy. Now, the concern here might be, well, wealthier voices are able to do that more effectively than other voices. But the challenge with that argument is that voters have, or excuse me, individuals have access to other resources besides money. So as we're seeing right now, every day on the streets of Rochester, individuals can protest. Individuals can collectively come together around issues in ways that don't require significant amounts of money. So there are ways to have influence in the system that do not involve money. Money is just one resource in a much larger sort of ecosystem of influence, if you will. But this notion of we're going to focus on this race or that race. So if you always focus on the outliers, you're not looking at the general patterns. And that's what the media does as well, right? So they'll cover the extreme races in American politics and not focus on the typical race in American politics. So again, are we arguing that money has zero influence on the system? Generally speaking, and that's not going to be a plausible argument. What we're trying to say instead is that the idea that campaign finance is and campaign spending and campaign contributions are the root of all political evil is simply not borne out by the evidence. And again, in an effort to help listeners sort of check their priors and sort of their potential biases, we've been hearing a lot in the past, again, year, 2 years, 4 years, about facts and evidence driving our decisions. And we shouldn't be driven by facts. It shouldn't be driven by fake news and so on. We need to be driven by facts. That's what we're trying to do here.
The book is called Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. And I learned a great deal from David Primo and Jeffrey Milo. And I know their goal is to make sure that if we're going to have public debate about this, let's come in with a framework of what's actually what the law says, what's allowed and what's not, what the reality of contributions are, and then at least start there. I think that's a good starting point, and I'm grateful to both of them for coming on. Professor Primo, always nice to have you. Thank you, sir. Let's talk again soon.
Thank you.
Professor Milo, a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, more connections coming up.